miss the needs of patients with disabilities. Join me on Prison Pipeline as we discuss the investigation of the death of Michael Barton. That's Prison Pipeline, August 19th at 6:30 p.m.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8:59. Coming up next, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, it's Fight the Empire with Parafalgarin. At 10, it's the Heather McCoy Show, and at 11, it's the premiere of Express Yourself. Jai interviews spoken word artists Izzy Israel and Jess. And at 11:30, the film show features news and interviews on the independent film scene in Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Cider Riot, located at 807 Northeast Cooch Street, producers of dry ciders with Cascadian-grown apples. Cider Riot offers 10 ciders and 2 beers on draft, darts, pinball, meeting rooms, and a vegetarian pub fare. More information is available at ciderriot.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. And as the news rolls recount the 6 cop injuries in Philadelphia last night, paeans of praise are being lavished on police as selfless saviors who risk it all. And indeed, the cops took a beating last night in Philadelphia, but I think it's important to keep that in a factual context. In a study of the most dangerous professions listed on AtlantaJournalism.com, policing did not make even the top 15. Here are the most dangerous professions in the U.S. in order. First, fishers and related fishing workers. So let's all take off time for a moment and bring our hats to our hearts for the fishermen and fisherwomen who are out there getting fish to us selflessly. I don't mean to denigrate the fact that they are indeed, for good reason, suffering injuries and deaths, but they're not police, are they? And nor are logging workers, number two. Hell of a job logging. You know, these people are lucky to get $25,000 in a year. And they work very hard for it, and they suffer a terrific danger for it. Under that comes aircraft pilots and flight engineers. And under that comes roofers. So the top 4 most dangerous professions in the U.S., in order, fishers, loggers, aircraft pilots and engineers, and roofers. After that, refuse and recyclable material collectors. So number 5, looks like cops didn't make the top 5. Garbage collectors are in there. Let's go on down. Number 6, structural iron and steel workers. Number 7, drivers and sales workers and truck drivers. Number 8, farmers, ranchers, and other agricultural managers. Number 9, first line supervisors of landscaping, lawn service, and groundskeeping workers. And finally, at number 10, electrical power line installers and repairs. Oh, wait a minute. That's the top 10. No cops in there, so let's go down to the 11th most dangerous profession, miscellaneous agricultural workers. 12th, first-line supervisors of construction trades and extraction workers. 13th, helpers, construction trades. After that, maintenance and repair workers. After that, grounds maintenance workers. After that, construction laborers. After that, first-line supervisors of mechanics, installers and repairers. And coming in at number 18, police and sheriff's patrol officers. So, I think at times like this, it's important not to fall for the hype. Now, I have a couple of headlines, and hoping to talk to Dan Hanelman very soon. Dan Hanelman, the director of Portland Cop Watch. And but first, this from South China Morning Post. 2 of China's leading diplomats in Europe have warned that China will not stand idly by, their words, if the chaos in Hong Kong worsens. Liu Xiaoming, the Chinese ambassador to Britain, and Wu Qian, the ambassador to Germany, issued the warning after German Chancellor Angela Merkel and the French Foreign Minister, Le Drian, pleaded for restraint and called for dialogue to defuse the crisis. The escalating diplomatic rhetoric came as the Chinese Foreign Ministry's office in Hong Kong condemned U.S. politicians for colluding with extremists, their words, and violent offenders involved in the spiraling anti-government protests. Speaking at a press conference in London, Liu said that the central government would have to act if the situation became, in their words, uncontrollable and, quote, would not sit on its hands and watch, end quote. He also said, quote, we have enough solutions and enough power within the limit of the basic law to quell any unrest swiftly, end quote. All this comes in the context, speaking for myself, of deployment of military and paramilitary forces near Hong Kong, and it would look like the Chinese government is getting ready to crush dissent. It also looks like they took at least the main guns off of their APCs, but it looks ugly, and there are supposed to be more protests this weekend. And these protests initially began over extradition and have eventually expanded into democratization efforts. So how will China react? And also, I wonder how would the U.S. have reacted if, say, the main airport in New York had been shut down by protesters for an entire day or so. Now, continuing with headlines from VenezuelaAnalysis.com, the Trump administration has imposed a sweeping economic embargo against Venezuela in its efforts to oust the Maduro government. An executive order signed by Trump earlier this month declares all Venezuelan state assets in the U.S. are blocked, prohibiting them from being transferred, paid, exported, withdrawn, or otherwise dealt in unless specific exemptions are issued by the Treasury Department. All transactions with Venezuelan state entities are likewise forbidden. And you can find that article at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. It goes on for a couple of pages, so I won't pass it along here. Latest thing is that government of Panama, well, the the Panama Canal Authority refused to go along with the U.S. pressure, saying that Venezuelan ships could pass innocent passage, something that's been signed on as a treaty by the U.S., and so that takes precedent. But now, if the electrons are flowing properly, then Dan Handelman is on the line. Dan Handelman is director of Portland Cop Watch and also longtime anti-imperialist activists. And in case you don't know, Portland Cop Watch is a grassroots group promoting police accountability through citizen action, originally known as POPSG, formed as a project of Peace and Justice Works in 92. And Dan, are you there?
I am.
I'm so glad that you could be with us this morning with so many things coming to a head in Portland, and you've been doing your work steadily for all of these years. What's the latest thing? I mean, aside from the weekend hoo-ha, what's Cop Watch been working on?
All sorts of things. The most recent thing we put out was an analysis of the Joint Terrorism Task Force policy that the Bureau floated to Portland Police's involvement with this FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force back in the year 2000. So it was the year before 9/11. It was on the city council agenda in what's called the consent agenda. So they were trying to sneak it through without a public discussion, and we pulled it off and had a discussion about it. And eventually, it took a while, but you know, after 9/11, there was a lot of momentum to try to get them to pull out of the task force. It was hard to do, but in 2005, we did it. Then in 2011, shortly after the framing up of Mohammed Mahmoud for the Pioneer Square bombing, the city rejoined the task force again. So we worked for 2 years to build a campaign to get back out, and after Commissioner Hardesty was elected, we were able to secure a vote to get out the two part-time members of the Portland Police Bureau from this task force. And now they had to set up guidelines of how to make sure the police interact with the FBI in a way that follows not only Portland policy, and that's what the most recent thing is what we've been working on.
It seems like the city council just doesn't want to let go of the JTTF idea anyway.
I know it's interesting because it was a 3-2 vote to get out, but then this policy passed 4-0, and I think Chloe Udaly would have voted for it had she been there. And the policy has what we would call poison pill in it, where the language says that the Portland Police can work with the FBI on cases of terrorism and or threats to life, including hate crimes. Now, nobody wants hate crimes to go uninvestigated, but there's also no direct connection necessarily between hate crimes and terrorism. I think in the cases where it is terrorism, it should be investigated, and if there's a task force, well, you know, I guess we'll have to roll the dice and see whether it's okay for the Portland Police to work with the FBI, given their long history of spying on people and not really being interested in the rights of anybody other than straight white men. But the fact is that what they're doing is, when there's an actual quote-unquote threat of terrorism, right now, Portland Police and the FBI are working together that maybe a couple of times a year. They only listed one time in all of last year that they worked together in an annual report from the police. But this could open it up that they could be working on dozens or hundreds of cases because there are threats to life in Portland all the time.
The poison pill in the agreement, a long-standing tactic. Well, you hinted at the FBI's historic attitude by mentioning that you began addressing the JTTF, which was trying to slide through in 2000. Of course, there's the whole history of anti-dissent activity by the FBI, but it is the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So I want to ask you, what, to your knowledge, has the FBI been doing? Have they said anything to address the influx of white terrorists into Portland?
That is not something that we have any knowledge about at all. I mean, you know, the FBI is a secretive organization, but the gist of, I think, your question is that the FBI doesn't really have an interest in stopping white supremacy. I think the FBI is more interested in shutting down leftist protests, and that's something they've always been interested in from the time they were invented.
Dan, you cynic, are you saying that they're not being even-handed?
Yeah, I think I said that.
I think you did. Okay, well, so that brings us to this weekend, and I imagine you have concerns about Portland police behavior, which Joanne just mentioned, what we have observed that, and what I've observed going down. For example, in August 4th, 2018, seeing that the police turned their backs to the people that they wanted to protect, which was the small group of people who'd come in to Portland to promote white supremacy, and pointed their weapons at the people who they viewed as the problem, which was all of us. Do you have concerns about PPD behavior as this the Weekend Violence Festival approaches?
Oh, I wouldn't call it a violence festival. I mean, let's hope for the best, right? I mean, the thing is that...
Well, I'm just going on what the alt-Reich has said they want to do. I've been listening to their videos. They intend to stomp people. They're coming here to hurt people. There's no doubt about it.
But the irony of the mayor, who's the commissioner of police, standing up and saying we don't want violence at this protest, that, you know, it just completely escapes him that some of the most worst violence that's happened at these protests has been perpetrated by the police themselves. And that's the thing that concerns us as a group that's focused on police accountability, that he stood in Pioneer Square yesterday with a whole bunch of people standing next to him, having made a video several days earlier where he said, we're going to enforce the law by any means necessary. And here's the mayor of Portland adopting language of Malcolm X, which was in the interest of stopping the history of oppression against African-American people, which includes the police and the long history of the police. And the mayor of Portland uses that phrase to talk about basically unhandcuffing the police and letting them do whatever it takes. And we've seen, as you know, you've kind of briefly hinted at it, you know, people shot in the head and in the arm with projectiles that were not meant to be fired at human beings. They're supposed to be fired in the air, and seriously injured. by Portland police.
And the response of the police at the time was quite gleeful.
Yeah, and well, and moreover, they said they have still yet to take responsibility for that. They still don't believe that they did the injury, you know, that they caused those injuries. So one of the things that we always have to look at, and you know, so people have these discussions about the Antifa and some of their tactics, and while we are a group that is based in nonviolence because we're part of a group called Peace and Justice Works, when you look at the overall power dynamics of everything and you look at the state power and how that state power reinforces the violence of the right wingers, I really find the kind of pushback about what's going on with leftists to be empty because of the actual violence that the state, as you have noted, but just, you know, even in their stance, by standing and facing off with people who are not necessarily armed in any way except with picket signs, with their backs to a bunch of people who they know brought rifles to the top of a parking garage.
Yeah, and that context doesn't go away, and Joanne was mentioning the chill that people of color feel when they see someone with a giant American flag attached to their pickup go charging through the streets. And they always want to, they meaning the flag wavers, always want to pretend that there is no context and that that the gesture, which is intended to instill terror, is free of any such intent and is innocent. That word. Well, so I want to ask you about this context some more, and I also want to ask you to comment on the Guardian article that came out about spying on the Oregon anti-pipeline movement, but I think we may have a caller. Mike would be on the line. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Are you there, Mike?
Morning, Kibu.
Good morning.
Yeah, you made your case for the why. Now the what and when and how. So my question to you is, how does it change the strategy of peace and justice in our community to organize without permits? Because this is different, because the past right-wing fascist, racist organization, free speech things were permitted, and the police were obligated to surround them and protect them. This is a different scenario, but you tell us, please, how do we do that legally so the cops don't get too reactionary? And my understanding is one thing, whatever group, whatever person needs an outlet. So we can't just surround them. We need to maybe parallel lines on each side marching by past like a march of shame, and they can move freely down the length of the park in the middle of that and exit at certain exits. But once we surround them, the cops have to get involved, as far as I understand. So please inform us about that. Thank you.
I think that's for you, Dan.
Yeah, I don't really have any opinion about tactics. So what I'll tell you is that, you know, there's times when Peace and Justice Works. Oops, I hear a dial tone. There's times when Peace and Justice Works applies for permits for things, and there's times we don't. There's times the cop watch shows up at protests that have permits, and there's times we show up at protests that don't have permits. And we've seen the police remove the permit. Like in May of 2017, at May Day, they revoked the permit. So people who had worked all this time and jumped through all the hoops and said, okay, you know, police, we need you there to protect us and make sure we can march through the streets, all of a sudden, on the whim of one captain, found themselves at the hands of police, again, shooting off projectiles and flashbangs, call them, even though that's not necessarily what they're called. They call them aerial distraction devices and other violence that was going on. And there's no guarantee. I think that's the sad truth, is that you kind of have to think strategically about what you're going to do and what your plans are if you think the police are going to come in and start attacking you and your allies. And I think you, Teresa, mentioned about communities of color fearing people in pickup trucks. I think there's people in communities of color that won't come downtown generally. I think that since the police have upped their game on violence against protests, that it's even less likely that people of color will come down. And we actually, just Peace and Justice Works proper, rather our Iraq Affinity Group, had a permitted rally a couple of weekends ago where we had a turnout of 200 people to say no war on Iran and Venezuela, and we'd hoped for a much bigger crowd, but it's hard to tell how much people aren't coming to protest because they're now afraid that the police are going to attack it.
Well, I have to say that the police would have stomped me pretty well last year. They were coming, and Antifa stood between me and them and blocked them with a sort of gate and kept them away. But there was one moment in particular I recall in which, those batons were ready for my head, and I was wondering how it was going to come down. So I've said many times I'm grateful to Antifa for keeping the peace.
So you were talking about that Guardian article about the spying that's going on down in Jordan Cove. And apparently, according to a piece that OPB published yesterday, it wasn't yesterday, it was a couple of days ago, that the company that's building the pipeline down there is giving money to the Coos County Sheriff's Office to do security for them. Somebody wrote to me a little while ago. We put out a statement about the government trying to criminalize anti-fascism.
I guess that's pretty direct corporate rule if the corporations are paying the cops to spy on us.
Which becomes a form of fascism, yes. So I think that's very concerning. And that article also revealed that on an email list for the Southwest Oregon Task Force is an officer from Portland named Andrew Hurst. And Andrew Hurst has been involved in two shootings. One of them, everybody will probably remember the name, was Quantus Hayes in February 2017, an unarmed 17-year-old African-American who was shot by Andrew Hurst's AR-15 rifle. And Hurst also used that rifle to shoot and kill a man in mental health distress at a hospital. Merle Hatch was his name, a couple years before that. This guy is somehow on this email loop and telling the Coos County sheriffs, we'll let you know if anybody from Portland is heading down there for a protest.
Wow.
So, backing up to the whole Joint Terrorism Task Force question, there's a law that got passed in the 1980s, thanks to the ACLU of Oregon, after it was discovered that the Portland Police Bureau essentially had a red squad that was spying on leftist activists, that said you can't collect information about people's political, social, or religious affiliations unless you have reasonable suspicion of criminal conduct. So the fact that Hearst is offering to tell the Coos County sheriffs if people from Portland are going down to protest the pipeline, when there's no indication that just heading down there is criminal in any way, means that he is in violation of that state law.
I had heard rumors of the Portland Red Squad when I first came to town in 1990, and one of the first things I did was just pick up the phone, call the police department, and said, can you patch me through to the Red Squad? And they did, and at that time they were denying that it existed, but go on.
But wait, so if they patched you through, how could they deny it exists?
It's easy. You just say with authority that it doesn't exist. And there, and this is one of the things that has been a hard lesson for me. As someone who promotes the news you're not supposed to know, and the idea that a society can be bettered by better information. Well, not easily, apparently, and there are people who can simply switch their minds off because an authority says a thing that they want to believe.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people like that in this country, unfortunately.
Yeah, I would say about 63 million.
Yeah, it's very scary.
Well, going back to the Guardian article,
yes.
It goes on for a couple of pages, and it included, according to the Guardian article, the email list for the Southwest Oregon Joint Task Force, I think is the name of it, included activists' social media posts, emails, and rally announcements. And as you say, it went out to at least one pipeline representatives. I'm trying to skip ahead in the text there, but I'm not finding his name. This I assume is going on. So this is the state of Oregon's joint task force, which is separate from the city of Portland's joint task force.
It's not even a state of Oregon. It's based in Coos County. So it's something that they set up, the Southwest Oregon Joint Task Force. There's a list of who's on it somewhere in that article. Here it is. It says FBI, Bureau of Land Management, Department of Justice, National Forest Service, Oregon State Police, and Oregon Municipal Police and Sheriff's Departments.
And so, of course, Coos County is where a big pipeline project is being proposed.
Yes.
So,
and people have been organizing it for many years, and you know, using various different tactics to do so, but including you know going to meetings and you know peacefully protesting and not doing anything that would be considered illegal.
And yet, quoting let's see, Courthouse News Service, Oregon property owners complained to federal regulators Monday that they were kept in the dark about a proposal to keep a natural gas pipeline on their land if approved, they write. The 230-mile pipeline into southern Oregon would haul natural gas through migratory bird habitat and old-growth forests. And skipping ahead from there, it would be shipped to buyers in China. So the information is kept from the people who it would affect, but ironically, has only been exposed by a London publication, the former Manchester Guardian. So it reminds me of that joke about a certain senator, if it's news in Oregon, read it in the Washington Post. Well, if it's news in Oregon, read it in the London Guardian.
Yeah.
Now, going back to the topic then of the Guardian article about spying on Oregon dissent, do you think that at the city level, do you think they are conflating dissent with terror?
Well, I haven't heard anybody use that exact language. I tell you, one of the most dangerous people in our city, though, is the head of the police association, Daryl Turner, who's the one. When I said before about the police were asking to have the handcuffs taken off of them for this weekend's protest, that was a quote from Daryl Turner. I mean, he said he implied, or not implied, he stated that somehow the mayor was putting handcuffs on them. So I think the mayor, to respond to that, that's why he said by any means necessary. Basically, he's opening up the door for the police to use anything to attack protesters. And Turner has called the city a cesspool because he's very anti-houseless. He has written so many things on their Facebook page and over the years in what was used to be called the Rap Sheet, which was their newsletter, that's anti-civilian and complaining about people who want accountability, that I just find their control of the political process to be very disconcerting. So one of the things he called for in a recent piece was a back-to-basics policing, which, you know, basic policing is take a billy club and smack somebody on the head. That includes carrying cameras on poles and walking around videotaping people at protests. And once again, unless the people are engaged in some kind of criminal activity, they have no right to collect information about us. So, you know, either he's ignorant of that or he would like to see that law taken off the books.
Well, now we're getting towards the bottom of the hour, so I do want to bring up another context. And I kind of hate to bring it up, but it's there, and we have to face it. And before I say this, I got to say, I'm not sure about my own health, and I'm not sure if I'm going downtown for this particular one just because I'm having problems with my back. So I'm not going to be hypocritical and say, go down there. I'm not sure if I'm going to be down there myself. However, I have the attitude that it is worthwhile to confront the influx of white supremacist fascists, simply because if we don't, the consequences are worse. But this context, of course, is the rise of manifesto-waving racist mass shooters. Do you have comments? Oh, and I also want to comment, I'm not going to be the only person, I'm sure, getting out the garden hose and dampening the surfaces of my house that face the street tonight.
Huh, that's interesting. To some extent, I think that those shooters are a byproduct of America's hateful foreign and domestic policies, right? The white supremacy that created the nation, and the white supremacy that keeps us in, you know, seven different countries now where the U.S. actively bombs on an ongoing basis, and nobody's paying attention to it anymore. The fact that the government uses violence to solve its problems, and when it doesn't like the way things are going, you just take out a gun or a bomb or a drone and kill people, and usually people of color.
And then lie about it and say that you're innocent, and then much later say that it might have been a mistake.
Right. And so, you know, it's, and again, we see that reflected in the way the police behave on the streets. And, you know, we've had 10 deadly force incidents by the Portland police in 10 months here in Portland.
Oh, now I really have run out of time, and so I apologize for the abrupt ending. But Dan Handelman, Portland Cop Watch, thank you so much once again for joining me. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Coming up, Fight the Empire with Per Fogring. You've been listening on 90.7 FM on our great big Eiffel Tower on the hill and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at The Cleaners at Ace Hotel in Portland. Bonds Over Borders is a benefit for Innovation Law Lab, a Portland-based organization that works to increase legal access for immigrants at detention centers, both locally and around the country. There will be live stand-up sets from Adam Passy and Dan Weber and live music by Pedro Queriega. Again, that's Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at The Cleaners at Ace Hotel, 403 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Brunch Box, featuring breakfast, burgers, beer, and more daily. From 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., serving Portland at 620 Southwest 9th Avenue downtown and their new location at 676 Southeast Morrison Street. More information is available online at Brunch.